As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TFA Football Podcast. I am John McKenzie and I'm joined by a very festive Mike Zimmerman. Mike, how you doing?
Happy holidays, John, and I'm excited to hear another American voice today.
Yes, because we have a very exciting guest in the studio this week with us, of Carlon Carpenter, who is one of the performance analysts at Houston Dynamo in MLS. He came to talk to us all about performance analysis, what a performance analyst does. Mike, you've just listened to that conversation. What did you make of it?
Well, actually, John, I would like to take this time and flip this back on to you. What were your thoughts on Carlon explaining the performance analyst path he took in the US? Because I know things in America are quite different from the UK and Europe.
Yeah, I always love talking to people who are working behind the scenes at clubs, because so much of what happens, none of us actually get to see. So really fascinating to have access to someone who is at the top of their game, like Carlon is, talking about what it is that they do and giving people a much better sense of what being a professional performance analyst looks like. And I think, yeah, especially his experiences of MLS, where he can be flying 3-4 hours to a place to play a game, just gives a real sense of just how much work and effort is required by players who work at clubs in order to be able to get through their tranche of games. So yeah, really, really enjoyable conversation with Carl. And as always, I think the best thing for us to do is to just jump straight in to that conversation with Carl, who is one of the performance analysts at Houston Dynamo. So Carlon, great to have you here. I think we should start off by congratulating you on a fantastic season, because you joined Houston Dynamo at the beginning of the season and I don't think many people even expected you to make the playoffs, but in the end you made it to the conference final. So tell us a little bit about how your year's gone.
Yeah, it was a good first year. My first year working at a professional club. Obviously I've been involved at various different kind of sides of more football adjacent stuff. So first time working for a professional club, the season couldn't have gone much better. Like you said, kind of the expectations for last year for us were probably going into this year were pretty low, but pretty much a clean staff now this year. New head coach Ben Olsen, new coaching staff, entirely new medical department, et cetera, and some new players as well. So we were starting off, you know, obviously kind of on a clean slate. And I think as the season got on, we had a kind of a rough start going into it. But I think probably about the 10th or 14th week of the season, we kind of found our identity as a team and started to play some really nice football kind of across the board. And as well, the Open Cup kind of was a nice cap on that, which is for anyone unfamiliar outside of the U.S., the Open Cup is the American version of the FA Cup. So we won that, which was a nice way to kind of go into the playoffs without that, and with that, you know, some actual something tangible to pull from the season. Mm.
Let's talk a little bit about how you and the coaching staff managed to turn things around so quickly at the club, because you went through a lot of changes in the summer. Well, I say the summer, in the break.
Yeah.
How do you, you said 10, 14 weeks in, you found your identity. Talk us through that process.
Yeah, so I think I actually joined preseason late. So going in, I actually missed the first game of preseason. And the staff that had been there prior to me jumping in had actually done some good work in terms of actually building out a game model to they did about a month of preseason in Houston before going down to Mexico, and they kind of had an idea of a game model. But obviously, that's always a game model is pretty much always going to be theory at that point. So actually, until you see it in practice, it's very hard to kind of make, you know, put players into kind of certain areas. So that kind of developed as well. Injuries happened throughout the year, so we had to play one fullback a little bit differently. We had to play center backs, you know, at fullback, etc. So I ended the season, I kind of did a PowerPoint kind of showing the developments of our game model throughout the season. We probably went through about 10 iterations in terms of how we actually wanted to play. And that week 14, actually, once we started to see, like, I was trying to look at trends in terms of how our performances were going, they were trending in all the right directions. And as we started to get results from that, so I think that's kind of the funny thing is that a lot of you can do so much work in terms of preparation for upcoming, but sometimes a lot of it's just happy accidents, and you kind of have to roll the punches and provide evidence, from my perspective, provide evidence of why things are working, why things might not be working, and obviously how teams are going to, as you find success, continue to counteract that going forward.
So you're talking about tactical evolution there as a sort of often happening as a result of a happy accident. Is it just a case of just running through different potential solutions to problems that you have and then seeing what sticks?
Yeah, so a lot of it is obviously the coaching staff are great because we're always trying to find potential fixes. We're not just, you know, coming up with game by game sort of thing. So how teams are starting to press us, most common defensive formations that teams play, as well as our individual strengths as a kind of a group of players. So a lot of that is trying to look at, okay, well, here's one possible solution we could play to kind of get the same sort of, so just to highlight for people who aren't familiar with how we play this year, we played with the box midfield, and we were very centrally kind of overloaded in those areas. So trying to find ways to build a team around that structure to put those central midfielders in the best position. And a lot of things, you can throw things against the wall and say, well, this is one possible idea. We need to get this guy on the field, so we can't put that formation out there because it takes him away out of his best position. And then obviously you might, like I said, it was 10 to 14 like kind of changes in terms of how we actually found it out. So one week we tried something and it didn't necessarily work, so we tweak it to get something similar but a little bit different. And the coaching staff were great with, you know, constantly trying to work out solutions and stuff, taking inspirations from other teams that we saw abroad or even within our own league, and trying to work out solutions that way.
As a performance analyst, you're often working on the theoretical side of the game, mm-hmm. right? So you're watching games back, you're thinking about how things can be improved. How does that process, coming up with solutions in a theoretical sense, then translate into the training ground? How do you find ways of implementing the ideas that you have? Because we were talking before we started recording just how little time there is to actually spend on the training field.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of the starting point is if you're trying to, using it kind of a way of an upcoming opponent, we'll do our due diligence in terms of scouting that that team and looking at how they play, as well as kind of looking at how other teams which play similar to us have actually played against them. So we might not use just the three most recent games. We might use five games, a game that was happened 5 games ago because, okay, they build in a similar structure to us. So taking inspirations from those, as well as also when you're actually looking back and looking into that theoretical side, actually trying to do it in a way which providing the coaching staff and Adin Osman-Basic, who's one of our assistants, who's people who might know him from Spielverlagering fame, is the person I work closely with this in terms of finding theoretical solutions.
And he's the assistant coach?
He's the assistant, yes. He's the assistant. And we're actually the two who are watching the games from the analyst booth up top. So we're providing solutions live, as well as, like I was talking about, the kind of the theoretical solutions throughout the week. And he's very good at, you know, knowing our game model, because obviously he helped build it, and also trying to look at those ways and saying, okay, well, this team did it really well, but, you know, we don't necessarily pull our central midfielder out there. Like, how could we do this in a way which actually makes sense for us? And obviously the use of tools as well helps to kind of to work that out. So when we're showing clips to the coaching staff before it goes to the actual players, we're using Coach Paint Studio, whatever your kind of choice of telestration software is, video examples, I'm pulling data as well. So it's a very well-rounded approach. To put a bow on it, kind of the way is you always have to go in with your game model and to contextualize it to yourself in mind.
Yeah, I'm already going way off track from the running order because I've got so many things I wanted to talk about. But of course, a big part of the success that you've had at Houston has been down to the fact that you've been able to integrate performance analysis into the processes mm-hmm. at the club. And that's what I want us to focus the bulk of our time on today. I'm just asking the question, what is it that a performance analyst actually does? But before we get there, though, I think it's important for us to talk about your own route into mm-hmm. into your career. We had loads of questions when we put out a call for questions about your route into an entry into the industry. It feels to me anyway that most people's route into the industry is quite non-standard. So let's talk a little bit about that. That's probably because there just isn't really, as things stand, a standard route into performance analysis. Right?
Yeah, so my kind of route is I had been playing in the US college level over there and was in complete vain, looking back now, knowing that I was never going to make it as a professional, so I probably should have stopped earlier than I did. But I had connections with the University of Virginia, who are a major college team in the U.S. I think they're the second most successful men's team in the Division I circuit. And I knew their analysts pretty well from I worked camps for them in the summer, and I knew their analysts well, A.J. Barnold, who's now the lead analyst for the women's national team. And he was actually leaving to get that job with the U.S. national team, and he recommended that I apply to that job with very little background in terms of analysis. I watched games when I was playing at sort of like a kind of an analytical level, but not to any of the extent that you would need it to be a performance analyst. So I interviewed for the job at UVA, and they basically gave me a computer with a bunch of the sports code with Tableau at the time to actually do data work, and a bunch of links to articles from StatsBomb, which is actually funny how I eventually ended up there. But they basically gave me a month to learn all these tools. So the first season I was at UVA, which was 2018, for myself personally, was basically the kind of the crash course of what analysis is. I would throw things against the wall and they wouldn't work at all. I would, call people up who are working at MLS clubs, teams in England, and basically ask them, like, what am I doing here? What do I need to do? And I found, like you mentioned, that those kind of traditional routes into performance analysis aren't as common. Schools in the UK actually have dedicated analysis courses as well, which is a nice change from recent years. But it's such a evolving and kind of developing field that, even when I started in 2018, it's completely taken a course now. So you see performance analysts who are basically coaches. You have performance analysts who are very data minded. So that's kind of as an evolving field, there's always going to be kind of like new things which sprout up across the way.
I guess that gives you a sort of sense of creativity because you can still decide how it is that you're going to do what
you
do.
Yeah, it was nice because at UVA, I think it was the only school in the country, or one of a couple, which actually had a dedicated full-time analyst for a college team who wasn't a coach as well. So I was able to kind of find my niche and try to find what I was interested in and how I like to actually present information to the coaching staff. And that was kind of where I work primarily with video, and that's kind of where I realized that video is probably, for me personally, the best way to get my ideas across. And there might be someone else as well who has really good data visualization skills, and they might want to show that with coding, etc. And that's nice as well, because I've spoken to people who have been performance analysts and kind of invert commas for 20 years now, and it started off them having to ship off their match footage to Prozone and on a VHS, and it would come back a week later. So now I can do things instantaneously.
I guess as well that what we're seeing in clubs is you fit the jobs to the personnel that you have. So like you said, if you're focusing on video stuff, there'll probably be someone at the club who will be doing the data stuff as well. Yes. And you can integrate that through them.
We're lucky at Houston that we have Ravi Ramaneni and Sarah Rudd, who work for SRC, who are a consulting group who've basically helped build and are continuing to help build Houston's data side. So I have obviously data skills, but not to the extent that they have. If they have they're bringing in a data scientist next year. So it's nice that if I was tasked with the same sort of things that they were trying to build for me, we wouldn't get as much value from it that way. But like I'm very good at like throwing things to them. Like, I want to show this in video. How can we actually put it in a data sense as mm-hmm. well? And then they'll give that to me and I can kind of work with it myself.
Earlier this year, I think you started up the Association of Professional Football Analysis with Ollie Gage. Mm-hmm. I guess the general idea behind that is to standardize the industry a little bit more, give a route in, which comes with qualifications as well that people can point to and say, yeah, this is the work I've done. Talk us through that.
Yeah. So as a developing field as well, performance analysis doesn't, like you said, there's no traditional routes. So there's no real traditional sort of standards for, you have to get this degree, you have to get this, you know, badge, et cetera, like coaches do now. So what we did was to try to start something, to basically kind of standardize that route into football and to give people who might not necessarily be able to go to university for performance analysis requirements actually a route into it by courses done by professionals who actually know what they're doing. Obviously, the work to try to get that standardized, like FA's approval, et cetera, is longer than we'd probably want it to be at this point. But I think it's also good because it's not a union per se, but it's also a way to kind of get analysts to unite and actually back each other and make kind of a growing sense of community. So the same ways that I actually was able to get into analysis by asking other people who were more well-equipped to answer questions, the association can do that now, which is great. And the other side of it, Ollie is more the businessman of the operation, and this is mine's more of the, I'm trying to provide goodwill. So reaching out to analysis companies to give people free access to courses, free access to software, because the software can be extremely expensive. And that's one of the biggest barriers for people to get into analysis.
You've already mentioned that you started out with UVA. You've also spent time doing non-league analysis with Bath City. Mm-hmm. You spent some time with the US youth national team, StatsBomb, and then you moved into MLS football. Yeah. We had a question from a guy called Tom who was interested in the biggest differences between the different analysis processes at each of the different levels that you've worked at in particular.
Yeah, so the biggest one, which is in terms of like an actual sense of like your workflows, is the budgets that you're working with as well. So with Bath City, I was actually lucky to tap into the StatsBomb sort of analysis budget, because my role at StatsBomb when I was there was head of tactical and video analysis. So I was working with tools that I was actually using with Bath City. But at UVA at the time, obviously, I was just one guy doing everything with the U.S. national team as well. I had a lot of people to pull with. And with Houston, obviously, I probably have I have more tools than I can even, think to even use at some points. So just from an actual logistical standpoint, actually trying to get your point across while being creative with how you present stuff in that sense. And then obviously just the level of player you're working with and expectations in terms of the standards of your work. So UVA, you're working with 18 to 21-year-olds. U.S. soccer, I was working with the U-17, so just 17-year-olds. Bath City is a wide range. You have young kids who are on loan from Bristol City and players who had extensive careers. We had a goalkeeper who played at Oxford, and he was, I think he's 39 now, still playing, 40 years now playing. And then obviously now with Houston, we have players in their prime and kind of a level. So also how you present stuff to them. So with UVA and with the youth national teams, it was much more individual analysis focused. So how can we make you a better player? You're still developing, you're at your development ages. How do we actually put you into your technique or your decision-making on the ball? While with Bath City and Houston, it's very much to a different degree, because I think Houston, with the higher league and the more money, there's the standards of actually success are probably much higher there. So you're also just presenting tactical ideas. You're keeping them. They at this point, you're not going to completely change a player's technical base when they're 32 years old. You just kind of have to keep providing with the information to do what they do best.
We also had another question from Yash Kumar about the differences between working as a performance analyst in the UK and the US. Presumably, there are big differences between the two.
Yeah. So obviously, I can't speak for a lot of the stuff at the higher levels. Obviously, I was working non-league, National League South, and then obviously MLS. But I do think that the use of data in American sports, just because of baseball's influence, American football's influence, et cetera, is much more accepted. And players understand that at a kind of a higher base as well than they do probably for UK sports. Obviously, that's growing. You know, there's the use of XG now. You see it on Sky Sports. You see field tilt now, which obviously there's issues with that metric by itself, but as well. I think that kind of, when I was presenting it with Bath City players, it was very much always going to be video, all video, nothing else, just because also as well, they were training two times a week. So I didn't want to completely regurgitate a bunch of information to them. While with American players and MLS, I found, and players that we've had from other leagues as well, they're much more accepting of like using data as well. I have to contextualize it, of course. I'm not going to show a player a bar chart and say, hey, you're not doing very well. But I think that the sense that data is a part of a game is much more accepted in American sports than it is.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about performance analysis so far without actually explicitly laying out what the job of a performance analyst actually is. So maybe we should start turning towards that now. I'm interested at the outset, in your mind, what is the job of a performance analyst? What is it that a performance analyst actually does, to answer the question that the podcast poses?
Yeah, so the role of a performance analyst is to basically to assess, diagnose, and provide solutions to problems in an objective manner. So whether that's an individual player's performance or the team performance, there's obviously multiple routes you can do that. You can watch video and provide objective feedback. You can look at data and look at trends and look at objective feedback. But ultimately, the job of the performance analyst is kind of a hybrid role between a coach and an analyst, to provide your team and your staff with the best information to you know, put performances on the right path.
And what would you say are the skills that are required to be a good performance analyst?
One, you have to understand the game. Obviously, it's hard to provide objective feedback if you have no idea what you're watching. Communication skills is massively important. How you present things is probably, in some ways, probably the most important thing you can do, because if you're providing feedback to a player, but you're doing it in a way which, you know, isn't helpful at all, it's, you know, it's too, you know, you're putting down, etc., is not a good way to do it. So communication skills as well, because there might be certain times that you want to present something to a coach and it might not be the right time. You might have to, you know, push it off to another day. I see that a lot with, because after a game, I'll have multiple playlists for players to watch, etc. And sometimes I'll go to the coach and say, hey, you know, do you think we should show this now? He said, no, I think we should probably show it another time. So kind of working with that and working with the players to kind of get them on the right foot without being kind of consistently throwing information in their face, because it can be overwhelming.
Yeah, and how important then would you say soft skills are in terms of communication? Because I guess, you know, the assumption always is that analysts can, you know, they sort of do their thing and, yeah, and everyone else falls around them. But the way that you present, yeah, yourself is really important, right?
Yeah, I think I've probably had it pretty lucky in my career, because I've worked with coaches who are very accepting of that kind of position in itself. Like in Houston, I'm in the coach's technical staff with them pretty much the entire day. So even though I'm not a coach, I feel part of the technical staff and I feel connected. So the soft skills, like you mentioned, are very important, because building those relationships with the staff to kind of work with them to get their ideas across to the players and make sure you actually know what you're looking for when you're watching the game is important. But as well, you're obviously working, I see the players around the building all the time. So being able to have a honest conversation with them and they know that it's coming from a good place as well is massively important. And that can be hard to do if you're not used to kind of, if you're an analyst who's basically, you know, put into the shadows all the time. But just being involved and constantly reaching out to them as people is really important as well, because they know at Houston that if they want to come with me for something, I'm going to do it from a place which is completely objective, but I also care about them as players and as people. So they know that they can come for me and be comfortable with anything I might come back to them with.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Now, you've just mentioned the word objectivity to me. We had a question from Ninad Barbadika, who was really interested in this concept of getting rid of preconceived bias from analysis. So he asks, are preconceived biases a thing in video / performance analysis for you personally? And if so, how do you still maintain objectivity in your work?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of ways that those kind of biases can potentially kind of drip your way into your work as well. So there's teams which play a particular brand of style who have played, they've had the same head coach for a while, and you might, after having watched them in previous games, so you play a team four times this season, by the fifth game, you might just be completely numb to how they play. And you might be losing a lot of the nuance as well from that, which I think the best way to do that and to kind of remove those biases from my perspective is to always make sure you're doing your due diligence and watching their recent games to see how they develop, looking at data to see if there's anything that might be slightly off to what you're used to. They might be creating more shots from counterattacks, so trying to look at that a little bit deeper. And those are probably the biggest ways. The individual side of stuff is, I'll admit, is very hard to look at individual, you know, preconceived biases. But I think that it's just something you have to be constantly aware of when you're going in to watch a player and you might be thinking about how they play, and you might have known them from, if you're bringing in a player from Europe who you've been watching, you're little, and you might be potentially coming to MLS, you might have known him when he was five years ago. You might, oh, well, he does this, this, and this. Well, okay, well, you have to actually do, players develop consistently, even if they're not, you know, changing how they play a lot of times. There might be slight differences. They might have, you know, confidence, et cetera. They might be playing more wide than they have been playing before. They might have switched their style. They might have gotten better at, you know, free kicks, et cetera. So just making sure you always do your diligence. And another way to do it is if you're doing it from an individual standpoint, you're actually doing scouting on teams. Mm-hmm. There's always people within the industry who can help you with that and provide really good feedback. So reaching out to friends who you know and say, hey, what do you think of this guy? And getting as many people, kind of a pool of information. So it's not just your own mind when you're putting everything together.
It's maybe worth us talking a little bit about how watching a game analytically is different from watching a game regularly. We both went to the Emirates yesterday to watch Arsenal play. And something that I get asked, and I'm sure you get asked, is when you're going to watch a game like that, are you just doing the same thing that you're doing when you're analyzing? Which is obviously not the case,
no,
right?
No,
no. Because so, we would die, I think, if we did that.
Yeah, I think that my mind would probably explode if I was having to watch every game and try to find like a one key point from that kind of thing. To use the example from the Emirates yesterday, for one, the angles that I'm watching games from is very different than one. So I was lucky to sit pretty much pitch side at the Emirates, and your depth perception in terms of everything that was going on the far side of the pitch is very different. And also I just enjoy, I came in to watch football as a fan. So it'd be really hard for me to like not watch Arsenal and get incredibly biased or shout out the referee, et cetera. Now, and I do find like ways, like when I'm watching games, as I kind of go into games, like looking at it and making sure that my eye is turned on for an analysis perspective. And when I'm watching it as a fan, I'm watching the Champions League World Cup final. I'm not going to watch as an analyst. I'm going to watch as a fan because it's the World Cup final. But if I'm looking to scout opponents and I'm actually going to say, all right, what are things I have? I'll look at their build up. I'll look at their progression through the middle third. I'll look at their final third. And obviously watching things over and over again help with that. I do. Obviously, there are certain games where you might be noticing something just because you've watched so many games and you see, for example, we were talking about, you and I were talking about how Arsenal were dropping Declan Rice out a lot, which was probably redundant. And that's something that I note from a tactical perspective, but obviously I'm not going to like enact on that, and I'm not going to put something together about, well, why should Declan Rice should stay higher in the build, et cetera. Yeah, so I think it's just sort of like a conscious thing of you're going in to watch a game. I sit down in my chair at a stadium as a fan, and I'm going to sit there and watch a game as a fan. And when I'm actually watching it on a computer, it's much more analytical.
Do you find, and this is something I think it rings true for me, but when you're watching a game with the mindset, I'm going to analyze this, that it's much easier to be objective in those senses, because you're almost doing like checklist stuff and you're saying, this is what I'm looking for, here's something I've noticed.
Yeah, because by now I kind of have a clear idea of what things I want to clip from a team when I watch them. Going into it as well, like I usually do look at the data of a team first, so I kind of know which things are kind of more overrepresented when I'm actually watching it back. And then going into that, I'm watching it just looking for those things. And that helps a lot as well. And obviously, I feel more detached when I actually know that this is for work. I'm actually to put this together to provide the best information for a team. So I'll sit there, watch it, and I'll be very detached as well from the emotions of. And I think as well from my perspective is I watch all the games from a tactical angle. So you feel naturally more detached because usually there's no sound on the feed. You're 6,000 miles away from the pitch, so you're not actually in the. But you're actually watching in a TV, you're getting close-ups of players. If you're actually in the stadium, you're hearing fans next to you saying, et cetera. So naturally, I feel more detached as well.
Do you feel as though you change your mind on things a lot in analysis when you're analyzing things? And in terms of, we talked about the preconceived ideas about what you're looking for.
Yeah.
I feel as though at the moment I'm going through a phase where I'm just like, I still think a lot of the same things that I thought before, but maybe I'm framing them differently.
Yeah, I do, because I've in my position, I have a code window basically, which where I'm using to actually clip games as well. And that's pretty much, I've had the same sort of base code window since I first started working, but it's changed probably about 5,000 times now to kind of develop. So that kind of nicely tracks my actually development of things I'm watching for.
Just to clarify, when you say code window, you've got a computer in front of you with buttons on it that represents
what's
going on. Yeah,
the code window essentially is it's sports code. There's other providers that are available, not to irritate anyone else who's working in the industry, but we use sports code, and I use a code window basically, which has hotkeys. So I press a button and it clips that moment for me, and I can create a playlist and look back.
And that's linked to whatever action it is. So it'll be like tackle.
So if I clip build up, I'll click build up, and then it'll clip that entire phase until I turn off the button, and then I can go back and watch that phase and kind of sort it and pull things I don't need to put into presentations, add telestration onto it, et cetera. And that kind of working document is a nice way to kind of track, because it's changed so many times that it's probably unrecognizable from what it used to be.
So that's the things that you're sort of looking for in a game?
Yeah, and I look for now, like I used to not really put much emphasis on for example, just goal kicks. The way we press on goal kicks is actually something we implement a lot and actually work a lot on. Because obviously there's the way teams are building out now. When I was 2018, I think the goal kick rule had just changed. And now teams are actually finding so many solutions to beat a press off a goal kick now that it's something that I've actually take really big stock in terms of clipping and providing the staff with information on. And there's other examples as well. Like I don't... you know, there are probably, just because it was hard for me to kind of conceptualize, I used to not really put much focus on like the progression phases, like between, there's that popular meme graphic of like, ball goes through here, don't worry about it, basically in the center of midfield. And there's a lot that actually goes on in terms of those phases that I actually put stock in. So
I'd like to talk our way through your working week. So let's imagine that we've just played a game and we're going to play the next game. So at that point, what does the process look like? Presumably you're doing a lot of coverage of what you've just done and, yeah. and think areas you can improve, and you're looking forward to the next opponent to determine what the week's going to look like.
In MLS, the way, I'll simplify it a little bit and kind of put the week where it's Saturday rather than the midweek, obviously. If we have a midweek game, it kind of throws everything a little bit, it truncates everything. But from Saturday to Saturday, the Sunday will usually present, Sunday's usually off day for players, so that time usually putting together the clips that I'm going to work with the dean on to present to players on Monday for a review. And by that point, I've already basically watched the team that we're playing on that next Saturday already, so I can kind of work on that on the Monday mm-hmm. as well.
So there's overlap there between.
There's overlap as well, because if I just started clipping stuff for the opponent, the way I watch 5 or 6 games of the opposition, it's really hard for me to kind of fit that all in on a Monday mm-hmm. to work. So Monday will be a recovery day for the players, and that's when we're basically showing them the recap of that last game on Saturday. They'll come in on Tuesday. It'll be more of a revamp session to get them going again, and that's when I start, showing in clips of the opposition. Most of the work on terms of actually doing like heavy analysis on that team is going to be the Thursday and the Friday. So you might split it to the defensive side of the ball on the Thursday, Friday. And you also do set pieces as well on the Friday as well. And obviously Saturday's the game. And a lot of those kind of the stuff that we're presenting on that weekly basis as well will need to match the training, obviously. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to look at the defensive side of the ball on a Thursday, the coaching staff we'll obviously work together to put together something which actually mimics that. So they'll watch the clips for 10 minutes in the video room, then they'll go out there and actually do what is actually being prescribed to them to do.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So you have that constant overlap between we're doing the video, here's the pitch, we're going to go and...
Yeah, because the way we try to do it, sometimes obviously you have longer video sessions where they go on for much, much longer. But I think that for... most video sessions you probably have around 15 minutes tops, just because players after that will just lose interest if you're showing them 45 clips of a switch ball, for example. But every time we show something, we'll make sure that it actually relates to training. So they actually see out there, they'll see it, there's actually evidence of what we're actually training actually makes sense for the day, because players ask a lot of questions. They don't want it to just know what they're doing. They want to know why they're doing it. So you work, the coaching staff are great at kind of doing a collaborative process in terms of making sure that everything matches with the analysis side of things.
How much of an input do you have in training sessions? Are you on the sidelines?
Yes. So during training sessions, I am filming it with a drone. And then basically right after the session, next year, I'm going to live stream the drones to iPads for the coaches, which will be nice. But then after that, I'm cutting the session apart, making sure that all the players who are involved in a particular drill or clips or their video, they can go and watch it on the cloud service. The coaches have clips that we want to show as well, because we'll also throw in training clips the next day to make sure, these are the kind of situations we want to create in training and what we did create in training, and then we'll show clips of the game scenario. So you'll have both two examples that way. In terms of actually providing the input in terms of what sessions we should do, from my perspective, it's ultimately I'm support staff, so my job is to make sure that everything is categorized. So when they want to pull in, we did this session a month and a half ago, Carl, will you pull up the clips of what we did well in this session, and I'll put that for them. So I'm more of providing them the actual evidence and tools to actually put together coherent training sessions.
You've mentioned that when you're analyzing an opponent, you tend to watch about 3 to 5 games mm-hmm. of the opponent. What's your process of analyzing opposition footage?
Yeah, so like I said, I kind of have a key points I try to hit with every single team. So we'll look at their phases of the ball. We'll look at some of their, obviously, the goal kick builds, set pieces, et cetera. And I'll kind of work on that, put together a working document. Because the way I kind of do it is I try to do things as simply as possible for the players. So we'll kind of look at high-pressing scenarios, when we're going to be in mid-block, and then how we actually are defending against them in a final third. And same for the flip side, how we're going to build from goal kicks, how we're going to build through the deeper areas, et cetera. It's simplified that way. So I'll basically watch the game from the analytical way and break them down simply in that sense, and then work with the dean and kind of filtering it, because it'll be after 5 games, you'll get a pretty good sense of how the team plays and which are overrepresented. And then after that, myself is where the kind of area I lead is. We always show them a key players as well as, so it'll be team-based stuff for the offensive side, but then we'll look at four or five key players. And we'll show that to the whole group as well. But then sometimes individually, I'll make clips of, say, we played LAFC in the conference final and Dennis Bwongo is the top scorer in MLS last year. We would show clips to our fullback and our center back of basically his best moments, ways he's been kind of pulled apart in terms of, like, you know, he wasn't his best when he had to cut inside, et cetera, like that. So that's the kind of area where I lead in terms of the individual analysis as well. And that kind of goes to the point where they know, I know from watching a game, and I know from just looking at data as well, conjecture, if, oh, this Dennis Bwongo, this guy scored 27 goals, we probably want to focus on him a little bit. So
We had a question about the amount of detail you go into when you're analysing opponents. So this was from S. Carmen, who said, how much attention do you pay to the tendencies of individual opponents? For example, some players like to dribble mostly to their left, right. Some try to pass, try through passes in certain scenarios. Can such tendencies be predicted and tactically tackled to give you an advantage? And you obviously started answering that question.
That is a lot. So there's a lot of times where you have individual players where they'll have a structure, but players will be given freedom within a structure to do things. So we always provide them with examples as well with the individuals who are going to be in that particular scenario a lot, but as well as with the team. So for example, just to use kind of a hypothetical, there might be times where we're looking to press a team a certain way and force them onto the touchline. But we also have to note that both their fullbacks are very good at coming inside and playing around the press as well, which just by their individual quality. So you've done your job from a team perspective, but as well be aware that if you're not tight enough to them, they're just going to come inside with you. And we'll provide tons of examples of that. Because ultimately, as much as we do in terms of prescribing hypothetical how they play, players win the games. And if you're not actually focusing on, you know, for example, we played Sergio Busquets in Open Cup final. If we didn't tell them, you know, this guy's pretty good at breaking lines with passes, he's pretty good at being press resistant, we wouldn't be doing our jobs. So
we had a few questions from people asking how much of an impact what you do has on the sort of tactical direction of the team. So, there's a question from JDB who said, how much of your analysis do you see translated into game plans? And Chris Kearney said, how much of your analysis is of what the coaching staff want to see versus highlighting things that you think they should be seeing? So you having a bit more of an impact saying, you know, I've noticed this thing. Should we respond to that tactically?
Yeah. So, there's kind of two sides, because obviously there's the pre-match stuff that we do preparing throughout the week, but as well the live analysis side actually during a match day. I could kind of touch on both. The pre-match side of things is we've gotten to eventually you reach into a rhythm, and I know what the coaching staff are going to want to see at a certain point. So most of my stuff is probably done with their idea in mind as well. But there's obviously certain things like for example, if we're focusing on goal kick builds as well. There might be something I've noticed for a team where they do a particular set piece routine off a kickoff. That's always going to be something I'm going to throw in there. There might be something that our coach who works on set pieces might be want to note how they change the point of attack by playing short. So if there's something which is that noticeable within my sense, I'll definitely throw it in there. And Adin's very good at noticing those trends as well, because he watches the games as well. So we kind of collaborate and stuff like that. The live side of things is probably where we're able to get the most direct sort of input, like in the moment, probably. So to kind of put together what the live process is for us, it's me and Adin, and I'm filming on the camera on my computer is actually going to the bench, so they're able to see what I'm seeing. And then Adin, who's kind of our tactical eye, and this guy is talking to me, and we're kind of like talking about the game, what things we're seeing, and we're always relaying it down to the bench to kind of give them tell this player he's dropping off, he's allowing the split a little bit too much between our lines. And that's the kind of the live feedback, and then they'll relay information to everyone. So there's always a constant collaborative process in terms of ultimately the reason they brought myself and Adin in is because they kind of trust our eye to actually make suggestions. And we know at this point that things that are going to be relevant to the game model. So
you started talking about a little bit of the match day stuff there. What does a regular match day look like for you?
Yeah, so match days are actually, I think I might just be because I'm strange, but they're relatively relaxed from my standpoint because most of the hard work, well, if we're in, it's an away game, we'll obviously show some video, mainly a recap, the actual match day of a game. But for the most part, it's mainly just staying loose. Most kickoffs in MLS are 7:30, so I pretty much had the entire day to, if we're away, I'll go explore a city we have never been to, or if I'm home, I'll kind of just sleep in, get a workout in, et cetera, in the morning. I'll get there prior to probably about a 7:30 kickoff around 4 to make sure that all my setup, my position, my analyst booth up top is all set up. The internet booth is working. The iPad is connected, et cetera.
And that feeds down to the bench.
Because it's also important as well, because when I'm showing up top and I'm connected, it's also I'm going to show to the coaching staff and the TV. So that's all interconnected between each other.
And whose responsibility is it to feed that information that you're sending through the iPad to the coaching staff? Is there
one? So Dean is sitting up with me up top, and he's the one who's basically showing it. And we'll run down to the coaching staff's room about 40 minutes into the first half and get clips prepared with playlists. Right. So they'll come, watch the clips for 5 minutes, talk as a staff, and then we'll go relay information.
There'll be someone on the bench with a corresponding iPad,
yeah,
right?
One, that associate head coach will be there with a microphone next to him. So they're talking back and forth and kind of seeing what he's seeing from pitch side level, as well as Adin from the higher level. Mm.
And as the game is going on, then you're coding as you go, are you?
Yeah. So I'm coding things that are going to be relevant for the post-match review the next day, as well as key moments in the game to show at halftime. So Adin will say, hey, can you clip that? I want to show that to them at halftime, and I'll make a clip of that and then eventually create a playlist and show it on the TV for them. So pretty much clipping, it's basically the same code window that I use. This, obviously, every analyst is different. Some analysts have a live code window. Some have a post-match code window. I like to keep things relatively simple. And I'm pretty much clipping everything that I'm going to want to use in that post-match review session the next day within that live thing, because I know it's looking irrelevant. So
it'll be like something's happening in build-up. You press the button.
Yeah, press the build-up, and then I'll turn it off whenever there's a transition. I'll start a transition button. If there's a corner, I'll press corner. So I can always go back and be like, also key moments are really important. So if there's an incident where, for example, it's also relevant for the medical staff, I'll clip moments where players get injuries, that I can clip it and watch it and be like, okay, well, this is what happened. And then they'll put that information down there.
Okay. That's really interesting. And then you've talked about being involved in halftime conversations and presumably post-match debriefs as well. What does that look like?
Yeah, so the live ones are a little bit more hectic for us because we have 15 minutes technically, but it takes them about 3 or 4 minutes to actually get in there. And then you have probably about 5 minutes with the coaching staff and then 3 minutes. So everything you have to do is really going to be short and sharper to the point. So me and Adin might make 15 clips for and only show 5 of them at halftime. And there's always certain times where we might want to show 2 of them to the players in their video room as well in the locker room. So those are very much like head coach, coaching staff will provide feedback and be like, okay, well, let's not show this one. This isn't really relevant now. And it's also the hecticness has changed because when I go down at 40 minutes, I've missed probably 5 or 6 goals this year, which obviously changed the complexion of what you're going to show. So if you're showing a thing of, oh, we're doing really well in this game, you know, we should keep going, and then we're down 1-0, it's kind of hard to pull clips that way. The post-match stuff, obviously every club's different, but we actually don't do video with them after the game directly. That's usually where I do the kind of the full length video meeting on that Monday after they're off.
And would you say that you're able to have much input in terms of what's happening on the pitch in terms of the analysis they were doing?
Yeah. So the reason obviously Adin is up there is because anyone who's read his stuff knows how tactically great he is. And obviously I have the technical skills to put together stuff, and we kind of trust each other to provide information. So they listen to what we're saying, because obviously we have the best view. When you're actually pitch side, it's much harder. Like we were talking about the Brighton game, it's much harder for the coaching staff to see the whole picture from that sense. Mm-hmm. So the reason Dean's up there is because they trust him, and pretty much everything that he says, they go back on and they go through with it. Obviously pitch side as well, is we're not able to kind of sense as much if a player is flagging physically, that we might suggest a substitution. We say, okay, well, he's not doing really well at left back, so we kind of have to monitor and wait for 5 minutes before we make a change.
In terms of data and tactile visualization, you mentioned that you're working more on the tape side mm-hmm. of things. Do you still implement data and other viz into your work?
Yeah, so the way I use data, because obviously we have the data department as well, and they're doing a lot of, they're mainly recruitment as well, but they're also providing me with kind of contextualizing things. I use the data from my perspective as more to kind of drive my work and make it easier for me to present players with the information. But with pretty much every presentation I do, there's going to be visualizations to kind of show. So if I'm looking at a team who get a lot of entries in the final third of the wide areas because they rely on their wingers a lot, I'll show a visualization which shows that, just so they have video and they know that as well, that this is what it looks like. Because there's obviously the idea of like the visual learner, kinesthetic learner is kind of been debunked now, but players like to be not shown one thing all the time. And it puts a little bit of a nice bow on things. So even if it's just a basic picture of a number. So if we're looking at a team who plays really heavily on the counterattack, I'll put together a slide which just says they create the second most counters in MLS. And that's like, those numbers are very easy too. I'm not going to show like bar graphs or post-shot XG, for example, for them. It's not really relevant. So
you don't need to necessarily show you're working. It's just to get it in
Obviously, I have that information. So some players like to look at the our goalkeeper likes to look at a lot of the kind of the advanced metrics for shooters. And Eric Svechenko is one of our center backs, likes to look at a lot of the defensive stuff as well, probably from his time at Celtic or Michelin, obviously, who are very data-led as well. But each player is different. And I have the information for them if they need it. It's just a matter of them. I'm not going to force things upon them if it shows that it doesn't have much value in that kind of sense.
How much work do you do with individual players? Do you?
Yeah, so each kind of coach has their own sort of, one coach will work with the defenders, one coach will work with the forwards, the midfielders, et cetera. And then obviously there's individual players who are kind of assigned differently. My job is to make sure that all those sessions are clipped up and provided to the coaches. I also will run the computer for them, the video, and put together what they want to see. And the coach will primarily be the one who's actually running it and speaking with them, because they're actually out on the training pitch, actually coaching them, obviously. But I'll make sure that it's kind of tailored to every player's and coach's needs. Sometimes a coach will just be like, hey, can you show me all of his touches in this game, and filter out the ones which you think aren't relevant? And I'll cut the clip down, show it to them, be like, all right, cool, we can show that in a video.
I mean, listening to you talk about what is involved in your job, it sounds very stressful and very time management specific. So we did have a couple of questions about how you balance your time off. So Brandon Manuel asks tips for dealing with all the heavy week to week schedule as an analyst, and favorite thing about working in football. And then Hadi asked, how on earth do you fit all of this work into a week?
Yeah. So, I think probably, I joined Houston in February and our season ended, I think December 3rd or 2nd. And I think probably in terms of like actual off days where I wasn't doing work, I probably had about 4 or 5 that entire time. Obviously, certain days I'm working a little bit less than others, travel days, et cetera, less. But the way I kind of do it is I make sure that I don't just – time management is really important. So I make sure that I have certain times of the day where I know 2 hours I'm going to work on this, and then I'll take an hour break. 2 hours I'm going to work on this, I'm going to take a break. I think kind of performance analysis is not a really position if you want to get into where you're going to be, oh, I'm going to have my weekends off. It's just not how the role works. And that's the same with coaches. And coaching's very unforgiving in terms of your time away from family, which is why you see both in coaching and in analysis, you see the shelf lives of those of analysts are probably, if you want to start a family, it's probably hard to get into performance analysis that way. But kind of finding ways to restress, whether it's playing, listening to music, working out, doing kind of stuff, finding time just to get away for a second, but always kind of knowing that you have something to work on. So each person's different. I'm probably a sicko in that sense that I like watching games endlessly. And that's why I've gotten to, been lucky enough to get where I am. But at the same point, I know that it's just not something where my work-life balance is going to be great from that.
What about the favorite thing about working in football? To give it, to give the nice side of things as well.
Yeah, the favorite side. I think just working in stadiums with atmospheres and feeling like you actually have a, you know, you've made a difference. If you win a game, there's the high of actually winning a game, like a big playoff game, a cup final is unbeatable. Because obviously you've been with the players and the coaches with kind of in the trenches for so long that you get that payoff. I worked in consulting as well, and it was nice to see teams that you were working with do well, but I didn't feel ownership to it, which is actually the reason why I wanted to work for a team. And it's great to, like, you know, if a team scores a goal from a set piece and you're like, well, we should probably highlight they give up a lot of goals on near post service, and then you see that actually happen, there's that feeling is really, really great. So,
and then off the back of the heavy schedule side of things, it's clear that processes are really important to your job. So how much of what you do is about having efficient processes in place to make sure you're managing your load, okay?
Yeah, that's the most of the actual preseason is kind of working out the kinks of my workflows in terms of how I actually do stuff together. Because I probably think when I first started, my organizational skills were just everything was littered on my desktop. And that made things a lot harder because if I wanted to find a clip, I would have to search for it. So making sure that while it can be incredibly tiresome to actually put together the workflow side of things, foldering, making sure everything's labeled properly. If in the long run, if you're actually going back to, if it's November and you want to watch something you did in August, that you'll save so much time in the long run doing that. And eventually now I kind of know what my week's going to look like from a work perspective. So I know what things take time and what things I can do in a quicker sense. So I know what things I need to front load in my week and things I know to back load. And that just comes with experience. It's kind of hard to learn. Even with the analysis courses you see in England, a lot of it's the kind of the theory side of things. But they're actually doing a lot better job at kind of preparing an analyst for that eventualities of, you know, I found that if a coach asked for something, they probably wanted it by yesterday. So you always have to be prepared for every single thing that's going to happen.
I think this is a listener question, but I haven't written the name down, so I apologize if someone did ask this question. But the question is basically saying, what would you say are some of the misconceptions about what it is that performance analysts can and can't achieve in their work?
Man.
It's a good question, isn't it?
It is a good question.
I guess people will come up to you with expectations about what it is that you do in your job.
Yeah, I think The problem is it's such an incredibly kind of, like, every performance analyst with every worked at a club kind of has different responsibilities, but I do think that they kind of overstate how much of the time is just me sitting there looking at endless things of code and being able to code things. And I think probably the coding sense in times of actually data literacy. Mm-hmm. Because when I joined, actually started working in performance analysis, my ability to understand data was probably zero. And I think now that I've learned to work it. So I think if you come into it and thinking, well, I have no idea how to code or use data, I'm not going to be able to work in performance analysis. You just kind of have to understand numbers in a football sense and what's good numbers in terms of your XG, what's good numbers in terms of a player's individual role. And then you can just kind of use that to, because obviously you don't have to be a data person in performance analysis, and you don't even have to be a video person. So if you have no idea how to learn the technical skills, the hard part of actually getting into analysis is actually being able to work and actually analyze a game prospectively. Yeah. It's just how to do it.
And we had a couple of questions about how to get into the data, the performance and we had a couple of questions as well about how to get into performance analysis as well. So Leo C said, what would be the recommendations you'd give to anyone interested in terms of courses to take or credentials to get? And JP said, how would you get into a job like that from scratch?
Yeah, hopefully the APFA is the association I started with Ollie is going to be hopefully something which people can get their requirements in that way. If you're in the UK taking those performance analysis courses, there's a couple I know the actual lead, leads there actually who are teaching those courses, and they're great in terms of actually, because they've worked in clubs and they know what it's like. But if you kind of want to take a non-traditional route, I think the biggest thing I did is every local, like National League South, even lower to the Isthmian League, I think it's still called the Isthmian League, they're always looking for people to help. And if you're able to actually show them value of actually what you're doing, you can get a lot of those skills of working with players and working with data, and you know they'll all have a VO camera or something you can do with, even if you have to watch a game on you know, iMovie and clip it that way. There's always ways you can get into it. And eventually, if you take those kind of initiative to work with it, you'll eventually get higher up the pyramid. And just be a persistent bugger to everyone and basically reach out, because the good thing about the analyst community is everyone knows what it's like to work in it. It can be unforgiving, and they're also very helpful with their time in terms of, hey, I want to get into analysis. Do you know anyone who might need help, et cetera? They'll always answer questions on Twitter or LinkedIn. Just if you show that it's coming from a good place, you're more than likely to get a reply back.
I like to end most of my podcasts with a question looking forward. So what would you say are going to be the next big developments in performance analysis that are going to make your task as an analyst easier?
This is actually something I've done a podcast on. I think outside of just like the tools that are going to make things easier in terms of getting your work out there, I think that probably the next big development in terms of that is going to be much easier for analysis roles to be routes into coaching rather than becoming a coach from the very off, because performance analyst is basically kind of a coach light in a sense. And you actually know what coaches want. You know, you've worked with players, you understand the game, etc. So even if you don't have the coaching badges as well, you could kind of get your route into those coaching roles as well. Because we say now there's a lot of pseudo kind of hybrid roles. You've obviously done an episode on that. But I do think as well that even if you want to get into coaching, but you kind of want to do analysis as well, you can kind of use that as a jumping off point rather than having to just become a coach from the off and do all that kind of stuff.
Well, Carl, it's been great chatting to you. I could chat to you for a lot longer, and I no doubt will continue to once this episode is finished. If people want to find your stuff, it's on Twitter at Carl on Carpenter.
Yep.
And also sounds like you're pretty active on LinkedIn as well.
I am. You can add me on Carl on Carpenter on LinkedIn as well. If you have questions, you can drop me a message and I'll always try to find time to reply.
Cool. And so thanks so much for coming in, and good luck for the next season.
Thank you.